The mayor of San Francisco, Gavin Newsom.
Thank you, Dorothy. Thank you all. I was in the back looking for y'all. Thank you very much, all of you. Thank you. Thank you for that warm round. Thank you. Thank you. Well, it's good to feel at home when you're home in San Francisco. Let me thank you, Dorothy, for the kind introduction. All of you, let me thank you, each and every one of you, for your constancy, for your faith, for your determination, for your contribution. I have so much admiration, so much respect for the ACLU that I'm indeed honored and obviously humbled to be here today to talk just briefly about some of the things that are going on here in the city and county of San Francisco and some of the things that went on here in San Francisco a few months back, just literally weeks after I had the great privilege of taking an oath of office as the new mayor in the city and county of San Francisco. You know, the oath of office, and oftentimes people talk about oaths that supposedly elected officials take, but the oath of office we all take, and it's the one oath that is consistent throughout this country, is to bear true faith. And this is important, to bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States, to bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution, in this case, the state of California, and the United States of America. And perhaps on January 8th, when I got sworn in by my father, who is a member of the California Court of Appeals, an activist judge by any objective standard, as I took that oath, those words truly resonated. And that oath was certainly fresh in my memory when I had the great privilege of getting a call from Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi to fly out to Washington, D.C., because she had an extra ticket as leader of the Democratic Party to join her and others at the President's State of the Union speech on January 20th. I went out there with great expectation, great hope, some optimism that the President would hit on the issues in Medicaid, Medi-Cal, and health care for all Americans, focus on the issue of job creation, job growth, focus on urban agenda, needs of inner cities and the like. Unfortunately, I was there as most, you know, we all stood up, standing ovation when the President walks in, as it's appropriate. I found myself standing again as he made the introductions, sitting down, standing up, sitting down, standing up. And then I started noticing a little bit of pattern. Everyone around me was standing up, but I was sitting down. And I decided, just the truth. And I decided, you know, the best person, I was peering right there at Ted Kennedy, kept looking at Ted, then just make sure that I was sitting up at the appropriate time, just when I was a little unsure Ted's not moving. And it was clear to me that, you know, the issues of health care and education, no child left behind and all this, that was all thrown out the window. The President instead started to talk about the things that truly matter to the American public: abstinence, drug testing, steroid use. I took that as particular offense out here in San Francisco. Target. And then, of course, on page 10, truly page 10 of that 11-page speech, defense of marriage. And I started to get it, that this was a very poll-driven, focused, grouped litmus for this presidential campaign. Now, that's hardly unique. Presidents use the State of the Union to advance not only policy goals, but obviously political goals, particularly around election cycles. I get that. But what was so wrong about this speech, beyond the fact it lacked any substance or any, from my perspective, and I mean that to be quite honest, because it just didn't resonate. I mean, that speech talked to the 10% of folks that are on the fence in 17 or so states. It hardly was a speech to America. That being said, it was clear to me at that moment that the president's private words were now being made public, that it was now clear in my mind that the president was going to support this constitutional amendment to write discrimination into our Constitution to advance the notion of denying people privileges and rights under the law, I argue, under the Constitution, deny same-sex couples the ability to marry. Now, this was hardly a shock to me. I had been paying particular attention since the Supreme Court decision and Scalia's dissent, where he was correct in his at least use of the following words, that clearly the dissent as it relates to Lawrence versus Texas would open up the doors to gay marriage. I think he was right on that. He was wrong to dissent. Needless to say, it was June of last year that things obviously began to heat up. Cultural conservatives demanding that the president support this constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage. It was only reinforced, of course, on November 18th when the Massachusetts Supreme Court did the right thing, and that was stand up Constitution. And all of these private conversations that the president had and his senior advisors had that started to leak out to Frist and others saying, it's a matter of time before the president comes out publicly. It's a matter of time before he comes out and supports Congresswoman Musgrave's bill to ban same-sex marriage or constitutional amendment, et cetera. And then there it was at the State of the Union. For me, it was a foregone conclusion. Now, I felt particularly powerless at the time. I really did. I felt like, here I am. I'm not comfortable where I'm seating. Obviously, I'm around a lot of cultural conservatives standing up. I felt a little lost up there in the rafters there in Congress. And I walked out, and I'll never – it's a true story. I remember sitting there. Y'all have to put your cell phones before you walk in, and then you have to wait in this line. It takes like an hour. You're all bunched in there after you walk out of the State of the Union. And I remember listening to people. And it was, people were talking about a country that I didn't even know existed. Certainly wasn't America. Wasn't a country where we're living together and advancing together, prospering together across our differences. No, it was a divided country they were talking about, divided in an effort to conquer. They were talking purely in partisan terms about politicizing this campaign to a degree that truly would leave many Americans behind. And it was at that moment that there was real clarity. Those words that I repeated, that my father was kind enough to offer, bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States, really came to the forefront of my mind. And I made a phone call, literally, as I walked out of the Capitol moments later. And I said to our staff out here, I said, would you do me a favor? I'll be back in about 48 hours. You heard the speech. Yeah, I heard the speech. Can you believe it? No, I couldn't believe the speech. I said, Can you just do a little research? Because I'd like to know what other cities had handed out marriage certificates in a non-discriminatory manner. I frankly thought there would be dozens and dozens of examples. I said, dude, just do a little research. I'll get back. We'll discuss it, the pros and cons, what worked, what didn't work. I was shocked when I got back to the office after the group came back and said there was simply no other city and county ever done it. I said, that can't be the case. Why is that not the case? Why hasn't someone come forward? We were a bit stunned. Now, with the ACLU's support, NCLR, and others, we started to have a conversation. Said, well, what happens if we, as a city and county, by the way, the only city and county in the state of California, which gave us every advantage to do what we did, because I could direct, as mayor, the county clerk to change the marriage certificates in a way that would provide non-discrimination as it relates to marriages. And we began the discussion. People were concerned, the politics of it as it relates to the presidential campaign and the like. But we all reflected quickly and realized those are the same conversations they had from 1948 to 1967 as it relates to interracial marriages in this country. People making excuses. 2 decades of tomorrow, next year, maybe someday, wait for this election, that election. And we decided then just to send a little memo. It was such a modest thing. Just a little memo, took a second on the computer, and we said to Nancy Alfaro, our clerk, we said, can you just tell us what it would take to provide these certificates and just make the changes that are necessary in a non-discriminatory manner? I'll be honest with you, thought it'd take 1, 2, 3 weeks, maybe a month. Barney Frank called. I said 1 week, 2 weeks, month. Other politicians to be named later called. I said 1 week, 2 weeks, a month. Don't worry. Well, she got back to me a few hours later, said, it's pretty easy. All I have to do is go on the computer with the marriage certificate. And I said, well, and then do what? And she said, well, it says spouse and groom. All I have to do in a somewhat dispassionate way is just put applicant one and applicant two. I said, well, what else do you have to do? She said, oh, that's it. Nothing more? We have to do more research? Yeah, that's it. We had the green light. And we went forward, literally, days later. And I'll tell you, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, I never could have imagined what had happened. I never imagined the depth, the exhilaration, and the significance of what we were doing or about to do in San Francisco. But what I did know is that I had long admired a couple of 51 years, five decades, Phyllis Lyon and Del Martin, an extraordinary couple, truly. And I've gotten to know Phil and Del for years and years as someone who grew up in San Francisco, admired their work on civil rights, going back, as I said, to the time of my birth, even before. And this was a couple that, by any objective standards, should have the same right and privilege and obligations that I was afforded some 3 years ago when my wife and I got married. And it just seemed to me, if there was ever an example of a couple that has struggled through more, a couple that has loved each other more, that has a bond that is impenetrable, a love for each other, a commitment, people that have sacrificed for each other and principles, that it was this couple. And we called them and we said, would you be willing to be the first couple? In fact, at the time, we thought the only couple that'd be married, that's what we thought, in San Francisco. And we were wonderfully pleased and astonished. They said, absolutely yes. And we went down and we got together, a good group, folks, again, the ACLU, all of you working together in concert with NCLR. And we began the process of trying to get them in before 9 in the morning. You say, well, what's that have to do with anything? Well, once word got out of the memo to the county clerk, a lot of these groups that have all these impressive names, you know, God and Apple Pie groups, you know, wonderful people with big smiles to come in and talk about, you know, the way the world should be, all look exactly like me. And we started getting the calls and the threats. And we realized at 9 o'clock on any given day, courts open. So we thought, if we can get in at 8 and Phyllis and Del, we'd just get a little jump start. And they couldn't give us that stay, cease and desist. And so we got Phyllis and Del down there. And, you know, it was 8:30. I'm getting nervous. I'm up in my office. 8:45, turns 9. I'm like, oh, they're not. This is terrible. We had called the sheriff's office, said, do you see anyone walking up the hall, the back, check out the back door? Nothing. 9:20, 9:30. And it turns out they had to go through the whole ritual of marriage, right? Is talk about birth control and things like that. I'm thinking, well, I'm not sure. And Phyllis and Del, this needs to be cool. Let's just get into this thing. Let's stop all that nonsense. Talk about, you know, all the formality of marriage. And let's just get this thing done. And finally, they did. And I'll tell you, I got that. There's a wonderful, that photo, that moment captured on film, love made visible, just extraordinary. That first kiss and that hug, that realization when I got the call that their lives now, this moment, their lives are being validated. Their relationship is being validated. And as I said, it's an extraordinary feeling, except it went on to follow, literally, for hundreds, no, thousands of couples from 46 states and 8 countries, people that literally hearing of that wedding, of that moment, drove out from Oklahoma, drove out from Florida, drove out from Louisiana, Northern California, Southern California, all across this country, came in overnight, stood in line, rain, yes, rain and shine,
out there celebrating their lives and our collective common humanity. It was an incredible period of time. I never imagined, though, I really didn't, I never imagined the rhetoric. And I've grown up in this city, and I understand a lot of the consternation around San Francisco. I understand that. But I'll tell you what, the rhetoric was pretty acute. And it was not dissimilar, if I may be so bold. Not dissimilar. Particularly people of my faith. Particularly people of my faith, if I may be so bold. Than the rhetoric that was used in the 50s, 40s, 50s, and 60s. You know, I remember, I look back, you should see this research. It's just incredible. You go back and, you know, I remember when the interracial marriage debate occurred in this country. A lot of good people, or at least God-fearing people, were saying that God put races on different continents for a reason. God never wanted the races to commingle. So was the argument at the time by many people against interracial marriages. It was the year of my birth. Isn't this extraordinary? I mean, we got to put this out. I'm relatively young, though growing older every moment, especially through this debate. But a year of my birth, 1967, where 16 states in this country denied blacks from marrying whites, whites from marrying Asians, etc. It just seems remarkable. It just can't be the case. I tell people this all the time. They say, that's not the case. That was in the 20s and 30s or something. People look back completely shocked at that, as they should look back completely shocked at that. And I am convinced, I mean this, I'm convinced that we'll look back at this moment in time, we'll look back at this debate, we'll look back at all of this rhetoric, all this friction with that same kind of disbelief. But I don't think it's going to take 20 to 30 years. I don't think it's going to take that long. I really don't. Really don't. Finally, I know I've gone on. I was just in Massachusetts, out there for the U.S. Conference of Mayors, where they took the bold step on a 46-44 vote, not to vote on opposing the federal amendment to ban gay marriage. We're leaders, mayors, standing on principle, saying publicly what we always say privately. We're consistent. You wonder why people don't vote. But it was an amazing thing because I walked the streets and something occurred to me. The sky is still there, hadn't fallen. People were holding hands, not just same-sex couples. Children were playing. People going to the baseball game. Saw buses, cabs. Just seemed so normal. Life was just being lived. And it occurs to me that the most remarkable thing that's happened with this debate is how unremarkable, in many respects, what's going on today as we speak, legally, in Massachusetts. Become. It's not a big deal. People going back to their lives, realizing that their marriage hasn't dissolved because same-sex couple marriage come together. That they're realizing in many respects marriage is being affirmed. The institution is being affirmed because we're opening up the doors to other people. It's an extraordinary thing what's happening. The presses didn't come to a halt. The headlines no longer reflective. Kerry is no longer the Massachusetts liberal on this issue of same-sex marriage. In many respects, we've moved beyond that because a lot of the stress seems to have been taken out of this debate because a lot of the rhetoric was taken out here in San Francisco. So to answer my own query, the point that I was making earlier about the concern about the political ramifications of this in a presidential election, I think in a curious way, it's helped the Kerry campaign. In a curious way, it's taken out the focus from Massachusetts. And it's allowed these folks a little spring training. Because I'll never forget that presidential debate where Anderson Cooper of CNN asked them their positions were all the candidates at the time on gay marriage. And boy, they didn't know what the language, you know, do I say, you know, gay and lesbian, bisexual, or do I say homosexual? How do I even use the language? And I think it's allowed people to really define their positions in a way that I think ultimately will advance this debate as the polls suggest it's already been advanced. People are coming to grips with civil unions, and we never thought out here that we'd get beyond domestic partnerships. Now civil unions almost seem passe, and now we're having the real debate about full non-discrimination. Separate is never equal. You know that better than anyone else, and that means marriage. I thank you all very much. Thanks for your great work, and thank you for allowing me to share some thoughts. Thank you all very, very much. Thank you.